You are listening to Mommying While Muslim podcast, where hosts Uzma and Zeba share their personal stories of mommying in a post 9/11 world. This podcast is designed with the Muslim American mom in mind, so grab a cup of coffee and pull up to their table.
Assalamu alaikum, everyone. Welcome to another episode of Mommying While Muslim podcast. This is Uzma Jafri. I am flying solo while Zeba is doing carpool runs. So very excited for this month because we're going back to kind of like an offshoot of a couple of series that we did 3 years ago now. And that was the media, both narrative media and the news media and their coverage of Muslims. And oh, look, isn't that relevant like all the time? We thought things had changed in the last 20 years since 9/11, but Zeba and I have noted that no, that is not the case. So our kids are dealing with stuff at school. Our sons have officially asked us to pull, or my sons at least have officially asked me to pull them out of school on 9/11. And during this current assault on Gaza, they're like, you know, feeling a little bit left out because there's a lot of other flags and a lot of other symbols being worn in the hallways and in the classrooms. And anytime there's any discussion, he's like, my high schooler is like, all eyes are on me. So I definitely don't want to go to school on 9/11 anymore. I just don't want to have to answer any questions and I don't want to get the looks. Nobody said anything to me. But remember, this is also the kid who was called a terrorist for like 3 months, his freshman year, by a football bully until that kid got suspended, expelled, whatever, withdrawn. I'm not sure. But he didn't tell me about it because he knew his mom is a fire-breathing dragon, would show up at school and at the superintendent's office. But little does he know, I'm still going to show up at the principal and superintendent's office. He had officially asked me not to get involved, but this latest attack on Muslims and Arabs has made it necessary for me. So I will be doing that. And for moms that are walking that fine line, when am I getting too involved? And when should I let my kid figure it out? When it's actually going to endanger your kid's life. Remember, like a young man has been killed now, I believe in either Germany or Austria, for expressing pro-Palestinian views online. Three boys have been shot right here in Vermont, in America. We talked about, you know, the one who is now paralyzed. I'm not going to wait for any more Muslim or Arab children to be attacked. I'm not going to wait for any Latin Americans to get attacked because they're mistaken for Arabs. That happened a lot after 9/11. I'm going to get involved. And I think now is the time that we all need to, because it's been over 100 days and it's not looking like it's going to let up anytime soon, with Israel denying any hostage negotiations that have been brought up. I think it was at the end of last week. So let's go ahead and show up to your principal's offices, your counselor's offices, and start talking to the counselors about pulling your kids in for some kind of therapy. The school is required to provide it. At least the district is, and you're paying your taxes, so you should get that. And it is obligatory on them to provide it. If they don't, then get it through your insurance. Get your kids into counseling fast. They all need it. They're not saying it. If it was available during our time after 9/11, you bet your booty we would have been in therapy, but we were not that educated at that time. So that is my public service announcement and my sort of introduction to the introduction of our series right now. So January, as of this recording, is 2/3 of the way over. And like we said, we are not done with this assault on Gaza. We're also not done protesting what's happening and asking for a ceasefire. So the situation in Palestine, the one thing we've noted is the first time in our lives we're able to talk about Palestine with other people who don't look like us or live like us or eat like us or dress like us or believe like us. So there's a lot of allies out there. There's a lot now that we have social media, because after 9/11, we didn't have that. Now we have social media, and there's a lot of narratives that are changing. We're able to talk a little bit more openly, but we want to know what that's going to look like in Hollywood, in film, and media. So we decided to bring an expert on. Our guest today is Syrian-American journalist, Dr. Maitha Al-Hassan. She received her PhD and MA from USC in American Studies and Ethnicity, and she appears regularly as a guest and co-host, digital producer on the English language TV current events program. You will see her streams on Al Jazeera, CNN, HuffPost Live, Fusion Network, The Young Turks, The Brian Lehrer Show. And she's also on the staff of a very popular Hulu show that we all love to cringe at and bite our nails at and throw our shoes at sometimes, but we love them anyway, Rami. We are so excited to welcome her back to the podcast. Welcome, Dr. Al-Hassan, and we can't wait to get into it with you. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam. Thank you for having me.
So for those folks who didn't hear you last time, I don't think you have kids yet, but you are now managing a child. So whatever you want to tell us about, you know, what that experience is like, where it originated from, and what kind of philosophy are you developing on the way? Because even watching other people's children, I think, is very good practice run for mothering.
Yeah, I would like to think, of course, it's not anything equivalent that me being second eldest in a household of six kids, but on a cul-de-sac with all my cousins, so about 30 of us.
Wow.
So sometimes I say I'm one of six, but in reality, I was one of 30.
Yep.
That I was a third parent in my household. I was another parent in the community. And there is video evidence of me as an eight-year-old prying my infant brother out of my mother's hands 3 days after he was born and carrying him to show my dad's camcorder, this new prize, this new baby. I would be horrified if an eight-year-old did that to my I don't know how comfortable, why they were comfortable, but maybe I had some mama maternal instincts earlier at that age. So I've been around babies and children my whole life, and as mentioned, felt like a third parent. So as we said before this call, my sister, who's 10 years younger, had a kid who's about to be a toddler, or a full toddler, I guess you could say, full 24 months. And I told her he can call me second Teta, which is mother in Arabic. I don't know why they were offended by it.
Really? The parents?
My sister, my mom. They wanted only one Teta. So yeah, but it did feel like I was a grandmother raising somebody who also, when I was growing up, I regarded as
your baby.
A youth. Yeah. A baby, yeah. A child. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's funny because as we're having this discussion, they're thinking through preschool. And this kid is literally the axis of evil. He's Syrian, Iranian.
Yeah, exactly.
but he's not in his everyday life, and it is embodied fleshbound being. He is not the axis of evil. It's just what, if folks don't remember, 20 years ago was the Bush administration, just so that we can pierce through that revisionist history, the Bush administration's attempt to really map our region as something terrifying, as scary, as worthy of being obliterated, bombed, flattened. And so here we go. The extension of that storytelling hasn't been sufficiently disrupted. But yeah, philosophically, what I do, especially raising kids that are not mine, is what the parents want.
Yeah.
I might add a little bit of Matha flavor. There's a video of me with my brother's kids reading Winnie the Pooh. You can see it. I think I've posted it on my Instagram. I might have taken it down because I realized it's my brother's kids. And I don't want to put other people's kids on my feed. But for a short period of time, it was there. And as I was reading it, I realized how violent it is for Christopher Robin to pin a tail on Eeyore. So sometimes I like to remix the words. And I said something to the effect to this two-year-old nephew that, hey, this is Christopher Robin abusing Eeyore. And then my brother intervened, can't use those words. But it was cool. And I don't know when we introduce these concepts to kids, but I think name what's happening in the world around you. As you had mentioned in the intro, I think children, especially children who are at the margins, can tend to be embarrassed by when structure, systems, or people push them even further to the margins. And so I think it's our job to name what is happening.
Yeah, I think that's really important.
Not to force it, but so that their feelings are validated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And depending on the ages, you know, young kids and even older kids don't always have the language and the words for, you know, what this revisionist history is causing to them, what it's creating for them, because there are systemic racist structures that are oppressive and didn't let us as adults speak out about what was happening in Palestine for decades. And now finally, because I feel like reproductive rights, Black Lives Matter for sure, has changed a lot of people's view about the way we approach racism in this country. And I mean, of course, that's why we now have a lot of talk about CRT, critical race theory in schools and stuff. People can actually debate it. 30 years ago, 40 years ago, we couldn't do that. So I think that's all important. Now, For those who are newer to the podcast and didn't hear you on last time, you've alluded to the fact that your family is Syrian American. Do you want to tell us a little bit about your family and what is it that you do and how did your family kind of affect that role that you now play professionally?
Yeah, and I want to actually make that transition with what you just talked about, which is growing up in the US in the 80s, 90s, dating ourselves, but
yeah, no, totally. We're Gen X and proud. We're like the last greatest generation.
I'm millennial.
You're a millennial. Yeah, I'm
yeah,
older.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, it makes sense. You have teenagers. Yeah, and power to the Gen X, millennial here. So during this time period, it's still we still inherited a Western education system that said that all good starts with the Greeks, and that's mm-hmm. where the
white that's West, when history starts.
Yeah, that's when history starts, and that's where the White West traces its understanding of history. And then for some reason, jumps to the Romans for a little bit. And then there's hundreds, almost 1,000 years that they don't cover, because mm-hmm. guess what? They're not connected to the Greeks. They actually are not.
Yeah.
But it was part of more revisionist history. One of my favorite things is historiography, going back and figuring out when our ideas in history were written about to solidify and concretize our understanding of history, because there's politics involved with how history is written. And I grew up in Southern California I look back at the yearbook and we weren't white dominant, but the power of white supremacy is to deliver the illusion that it is all seeing, all knowing, and omnipresent. And even growing up in a diverse setting with Latinx, Latine folks, Asian folks, Pacific Islander folks, not that many Arabs, some Muslims, like very small, tiny, but brown folks, Indian folks, it still felt like it was ruled by white supremacy. And those were the dictates that we lived by, including the kind of books we were reading, the history we were being taught, the cultural values that, interesting enough, were in a transition point. I remember the time when we had it wasn't winter break, it was Christmas break, it was mm-hmm. Easter break. And then there was the shift around winter break and the backlash, the resistance to that, mm-hmm. spring break. We still celebrate Thanksgiving. What kind of myth making are we still continuing to absorb and embrace around this country? But I will say, had I encountered one of the most profoundly important interventions was the autobiography of Malcolm X for me. Yeah. Had I encountered it in high school, I mean, I'm so grateful to have encountered it in the book, the autobiography of Malcolm X as told to Alex Haley in college. In high school, oh my God, the kind of trauma and somatic experiencing that's locked into my body, because I didn't have a language around, as you had mentioned, why I felt like I was at the margins, why it felt like a white supremacist culture, why white aesthetics felt like it was the pinnacle of beauty, mm-hmm. and then beauty equaling goodness, right? And to explain how my little kid self felt picking up an issue of Vogue, and I loved fashion, I loved reading Vogue, but they were just skinny white women. Mm-hmm. And I didn't understand all the connections that history, that image making, that equating of whiteness with beauty, with innocence meant to my own notion of self. And then of course, even this time period is before 9/11. So yeah. The very little that I heard about my own background, the erasure of the Middle East in any of that history making, North Africa, Africa in general, yeah. Muslims, you know, there might have been a progressive teacher that did like a week or a day on the golden age of Islam, because you maybe couldn't avoid it for like AP world history. But that world was so profoundly dismissed or unengaged that it really set up a shift for me post 9/11. As you had mentioned at the beginning of that question, I had thought of myself as Syrian because my dad's family is from Aleppo. But part of their own internal erasure, also back home because of nationalism, was the disavowing or the disconnection from their Arab Bedouin history and background. Mm. So later in the game of all house and family tree, I find out that my grandfather and my paternal grandfather, who had passed away before I was born, was from a Bedouin tribe that he was a part of in a different city that wasn't Aleppo. It's called Sukhni, and then made his way to the city. And because of that indigenous sort of, for lack of a better term, tribal culture, folks from his generation were not trained to become doctors or lawyers. They were just tribal arbiters, right? And mm-hmm. that's how they gained their sense of reputation or accreditation within their communities. So I started to realize, wow, there's something about the indigeneity of, again, for lack of a better term, I'm sure I'm going to develop more of a language around this, that really had me openly listening to, embracing, and receiving the wisdom of indigenous communities on Turtle Island, and more recently, really interested in studying with folks who come from a Hawaiian background, Polynesian background. And it's just remarkable to see what nationalism, colonialism did to our relationships that go far beyond this new thing called the nation state.
Yeah.
So long story, my dad's side, so I found that out. And then my mom's side, she was raised in primarily in Lebanon. She was born in Syria, but her ancestry goes back to Arabia and Egypt. And for much longer answer than the one I have present for you, her family has Saudi citizenship. So
oh.
I'd like to say that I unite all of the Middle East, I guess.
All of the dialects of Arabic. Your mom
yeah,
said
pretty
that
much
basically,
within,
yeah.
Within my family. And then I have cousins who their mothers are Gazan, Palestinian, or married into Palestinian families.
Because the Ottoman Empire did not create nation states. They were just kind of regions, right? So
yeah,
there was
yeah,
a lot
yeah.
of intermixing possible, you know, and all of these places are majority like Islam practicing countries. But finding out about your family tree, is that what colored like your research and your deep dive into, you know, Muslim portrayals?
I'm just such a nerd for genealogy and that kind of tracing. And I would argue in some ways our communities are stronger than Ancestry or 23andMe because of the oral tradition, transmission of info. Actually, my quest to understand where I was from, it has been lifelong. You know, there were different iterations of it, and connected to how we are understood through media really started off in a couple of benchmarks, flashpoints. This is back in the day when there were a couple of network channels. CNN, I think, was about to launch. I would watch my dad responding back to the news with the counter narrative.
Yeah.
This is not how it is.
He's just talking to the TV or shouting at it. Yeah. I had that
and
dad too.
Made me curious, why would this thing, you know, as a kid that probably is under the age of 10 at this point, why would the news say something like that? And I know a lot of us after 9/11, I've always been interested in this and wondered how many people this influenced. But after 9/11, there was a wave, not the first wave, but one of many of Arabs, Muslims who wanted to get into journalism and push back against what might have been a narrow set of careers that their immigrant parents presented to them. And I was one of those. However, I grew up in kind of an anomaly of a household. So my father saw me, even though I was the second eldest and had an older brother, he saw me as his heir apparent. I actually only had two career paths in his mind that I could choose from or maybe do both. And it wasn't doctor, it wasn't lawyer. He wanted me to take over the family business, or he wanted me to be a congresswoman. That was his dream.
Wow.
Yeah. And as a kid, he would take us to, you know, we would go and work for my dad at car dealerships on the weekends. If we wanted to see him, we're listening to him talk back to the TV, talk back to the news. And then on other points of his free time, he would go to political fundraisers, do canvassing, take us to protests, phone banking, all the things. And we would go with him. So we had exposure to the world of politics, local politics in particular, and what it meant to be participatory in it. In fact, he took us to city council
That's
meetings,
amazing. That's,
or he forced us. I mean,
yeah, of course.
no,
And you didn't have phones back then to distract you, so you actually had to
no,
listen.
no, 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 not at all. I remember he also begged me to write letters to the editor in the local newspaper. Yeah, so this was part of his vision of what it meant to be civically engaged. And my mom was very much involved in PTA and was recognized actually by the district for her involvement. So here you have us being involved in civic life. And then 9/11 happens, and I am, because of this political trajectory, or what I imagine to be my political trajectory, I am working in the constituents office for my local congressperson. And I'm hearing all the constituent calls. So I'm at the local district office, not the DC office. And I was a teenager at this point, but I wasn't prepared for the level of ignorance, ridiculousness, and offensiveness that was coming through the telephone. And boy, was I really grateful that there was no video monitoring, and it was a telephone between me and somebody that would say, "I don't know why we're not going to all the gas stations and rounding them up. We know it's not me. We know it's not you. We know it's no blue-eyed, blonde-haired German." I was like, dude, thank God for a phone. This is a time when anthrax threat was hitting the airwaves. So that combined with me starting university, where it was a field of exploring ideas, of shifting. At a certain point, I realized, okay, I'm not going to be in the halls of dominant power, but I want to be a check on that power. So I got involved in journalism from various angles, whether it was, as we mentioned, online writing, CNN's, the HuffPost. And then somehow, strangely, I got on this trajectory towards on-air broadcast journalism. And that was being a host, being a producer, a pundit, all the things, a correspondent. And then I somehow got roped into academia. And in academia, I thought to myself, journalism is great, but anthropology is the extended, deeper version of journalism. You do field work for a year, so you really get to know communities. And I wanted to know my own history, my own community history. And again, as I got really involved with movement work, and when I was in New York, I got involved in prison abolition. So all these things are coalescing together, and I'm seeing things are coming together. And then I'm also being asked, as you might be familiar with, and listeners might, to do these 101s on Islam, on Arabs at high schools, at colleges. And for some reason, I start a lot of these talks with images from the media. And one of my friends who had booked me to do a talk to his child's high school in Cleveland said, "Oh, you know, it's really interesting. You started with Hollywood, that's so LA of you." And I didn't think anything of it because I thought, how else are they understanding who we are unless they're friends with us, unless they're in community with us? And so that began the ways that I saw who we are. And again, learning about critical race theory, studying gender, studying Orientalism, studying Black freedom movements. All of it was just coming together in media representation and knowing what I know or knew at the same time working in journalism.
And then it was your study that we had fallen into last time and read your findings. And that's why we had invited you last time. We're like, this is incredible. But to have evidence behind your findings, that was really important to us because now we had data to provide to people. And, you know, for those who don't know what your study was, can you talk about this 100 years of Arab Muslim tropes that you studied and what were like your top findings at that time?
I thought, let's go to TV and film and see how we're represented. While some other centers at universities would study the quantitative data, I just felt like there needed to be a qualitative report out there. And 100 years I marked at the start of the 1921 film called The Sheikh. It was actually an adaptation of a book, and it's, if you want to hear one of the most ridiculous plot lines in a book and TV, just read the Wikipedia on it. And so that's where I marked it, was thinking about, you know, maybe there's a little bit before that, but we're talking about silent film representations. But what could we find and see thematically if we decided to unfold or think through 100 years? And I was also inspired by Jack Shaheen, media scholar who primarily studied representation of Arabs on TV and film in Hollywood, where he studies 1,000 films. Yeah. With representation of Arabs, and then he gives them a score, because he's thinking through the representations as related to political moments and how they're influenced. And through this, looking at these images, thinking about the political current events that were happening, I also came up with this idea of a triangle of politics, pop culture, and public opinion. Mm-hmm. And so in this triangle, we see that it's not just media influencing public opinion, and it's not just politics also influencing public opinion. It's all three working dynamically in concert with each other to influence all these little dots, the three dots within the triangle, and then our overall impression, opinion, and then actions towards right. Muslims and Arabs, who we are and how we're represented. And again, this was like primarily an auditing of Western media. More specifically, U.S. You're talking about at the beginning, your son feeling a certain way, but also not wanting you to say something because of that conflict within knowing how we're being understood and portrayed, right? Mm-hmm. It's that same unease we felt watching Bugs Bunny as a sheikh.
I'm wondering if you, as someone who has, you know, kind of an arm in pop culture, a leg in pop culture, are you noticing any trends? Are you hearing anything in Hollywood or in the entertainment industry right now that is indicating that there's going to be a shift in these tropes, or are they just going to be perpetuated?
What's fascinating about this moment, as I've noted in this report called Huck in Hollywood, which came out in 2018, is how Muslims and Arabs were spoken of or portrayed as versus what comes in response to Trump, actually, a right. wanting to hear from a open door towards some agency making that we had already been trying to put our foot through in journalism, as I mentioned, after 9/11, after the Iraq War, especially with this call for a Muslim registry, with the executive order of a Muslim ban. That's when you saw us entering these spaces. And again, strangely enough, what I said in this report is that the liberal outrage around Trump opened a door for us, strangely, because the thing is that we should honestly confront and realize is the reason they hate Trump and the reason they can't stand the fascists and make it seem like it's doomsday apocalypse when
you
it's apocalypse
ticket.
Right
yeah.
now for right. what's happening to Palestinians under Biden, under a allegedly liberal administration, is because the gloves were off and he was breaking the illusion around polite racism. And so that jeopardized the ability to maintain structures and systems because it was so blatant. It was so explicit. And so in order to manage maintaining these systems with some sort of control, there were levers that were moved around because Trump was seen as the worst possible thing. I'm not saying that he's not terrible, but you know, when Trump was elected, for the rest of the globe, it was, okay, now you're getting what we get from America. So I don't know if things are getting better, but things are shifting and changing in how we're engaging content, news, to form our opinion around stories and storytelling and politics.
Attention, DC Metro listeners. Remember, we had everyone save the date for 2/24/24. Well, we're headed back to the DC Metro area for our first ever Iman Entrepreneur Expo, where we hope you can get some of your Ramadan shopping done early. We're just going to have you go and support Muslima businesses. That'll be super fun. But then in the evening, we have a special event planned for you, and that is our Empower and Elevate Gala, where we will be raising funds for three different charities. Tickets are $65 basic ticket and $100 for the VIP package with lots of extra goodies for you. If you use the code EARLYBIRD, all one word, you can check out for 15% discount until January 31st. So that's just a few days away. If you haven't gotten an email to these events, let us know at salam@mommingwhilemuslim.com and we'll be happy to send you an invite.
A real rupture was 2021 with the ethnic cleansing of East Jerusalem. And so when we heard Muhammad al-Kurd, who was one of the families who had been pushed by settlers to the back of their own house and their family being threatened again to be formally completely kicked off of their land, along with other Palestinian families in East Jerusalem. When we heard his story, that you cannot dispute dynamics, the material violence of these political choices. And so people were starting to get confused, right? Like, wait, what is happening here? And actually, strangely now, you're hearing folks who are Zionists saying, okay, I don't support settlements, right? Like that was a big shift from, again, as you said, us even using the term Palestinian or Gaza, what's happening here? And then, you know, I want to bring something up, which I don't know if people have really understood the power of what's happening in this moment. Mutaz Aziz, Aziz, a photographer, he has 18 million followers right now. He is 24. Bassan also, and Bassan has 4 million. Let me tell you something which is fascinating. CNN has 20 million followers. Mutaz, his stories, his videos, his reels have more views than all American news media combined. I sat there and I added all of it. I added the ABCs, the CNNs, the Fox News, the MSNBC. And for several videos, I'm not talking about just one. I'm talking about a preponderance of videos and views. He is
outnumbering them. Just
crazy. Remarkably so. So what is that telling you?
There's more people watching and listening for these narratives.
And people are, I don't want to say and make the big leap, trusting, but there's a sense of, if somebody's on the ground and I'm seeing it with my own eyes, then it's a little bit more trustworthy than an American media outlet that can't even go there. And why can't it go there? And when it does have a Clarissa Ward go there less than a day,
I can't
and
stomach
it's still
that woman.
Horrifying. Or when a visit is controlled by the IDF. So I think what's happening right now with mainstream, especially Western media, they're trying to catch up with what's happening rapidly, unfiltered, transparently online from people on the ground. They can't reach those same grounds. Two, their reporting is also being challenged very quickly. So the kind of propaganda that weapons of mass destruction, 40 beheaded babies, all of that sort of stuff, they were trying it again. They thought it could work. They thought the tactics pre-social media could work with us when it was so quick and clear to challenge these institutions. And I think what they're not appreciating, 2016 became a rupture between institutions and questionings of institutions. And so that kind of sense of distrust in what had formerly been understood as credible, people are not appreciating, or these institutions don't realize how much work they have to do to regain public trust. And I think the other thing that I would say, which I'm still waiting for a kind of accountability from media, is the retraction, the death by retraction. Mm-hmm. So as they're being forced to challenge things, that who bombed the hospital, to whatever the propaganda they're fed by the state of Israel, to not challenge that propaganda, and then to have the Washington Post say, actually, this is probably them, to have CNN retract the 40 beheaded baby story, the amount of material violence at the hands of those headlines, that storytelling, is so hard to quantify, but we can see what it emboldens. It's not emboldening a public opinion. That's been the shift. It's been remarkable to see that there's an overwhelming majority of Americans that are calling for a ceasefire. We're flooding our representatives with a call for ceasefire. And then we've seen the squad push through a ceasefire. And then, you know, you asked about Hollywood. There is an Artist for Ceasefire petition with really big, powerful names.
Yeah.
But we also didn't see any mention of that at the Golden Globes or the Emmys. I mean, Rami, I don't know if you've seen the clips of Rami at the Golden Globes.
I didn't. Did he say something?
Well, he was on the red carpet and he had mentioned it to a couple of outlets. And I think he said something to the effect of, what's on all our minds right now is ceasefire and that Jeremy shouldn't do another Calvin Klein campaign, Jeremy White, who was the bear. But, you know, he's trying to twist it with humor. I mean, to be honest, Ozma, I don't know what the trajectory and fate is. And we're in a 2024 election year. I'm an executive producer for a docuseries on the history of Muslims in the U.S. Wow. Called American Muslims, A History Revealed. It's going to be released later this year through PBS Digitals. And we're taking through characters, Muslim characters, points of American history and showing you how they shaped American history and shifted how we understand what America is and what America isn't, and reclaim our own authorship in the story of the becoming of America. I've noticed the desire for this from Muslims and non-Muslims and the kind of fascination that people have when they watch our stories that start from before the founding of this nation. Rami, you can still watch 3 seasons of Rami on Hulu. And then you have a full series on a Palestinian refugee called Mo on Netflix that won critical acclaim. You can even go on Netflix and go to Palestinian stories and you can hear and see more. And I would say, I would also like to direct people, I know a lot of people might have missed this, but in our season 3, Rami and I co-wrote an episode on Rami going to 4867 to Palestine, Israel, and crossing the wall or crossing a checkpoint. And I mean, it was a miraculous story to have done. We filmed it there.
Yeah.
And we filmed it with a Palestinian production company as well. So we had Palestinian actors. Actually, I should tell you a little bit about this story because it's kind of fascinating. We were there May 2022 and we were working with director Anne-Marie Josser, Hiyama Bass, who, you know, was in Succession and is a mom on Rami, was also playing the role of consulting producer. She is from Haifa. So we were all there for the filming and we needed to cast 2 young preteen boys to play the role of Palestinian children that Rami meets at a checkpoint, because we wanted to tell the story of how Palestinian children are targeted.
Adultified.
Yes, adultified. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one of the tropes is the killer kids, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And exterminate the moms because they're the womb carriers of those children.
Which is like classic definition of genocide.
And if there is a certain kind of brainwashing around how dangerous a Palestinian kid is, how dangerous their mom might be for producing them, how are you going to be compelled by the argument of women and children if that's already been yeah. stuck in your psyche? The level of ridiculousness is profound, but it doesn't mean that it's not stuck in our brains, right? Mm-hmm. So these kids were from Jenin, the Freedom Theater in Jenin, which is a very well-known place that has trained Palestinian actors and puts on plays and performances. So we were trying to get them a permit to leave, to cross over to what is 48, which is, you know, Israel. And we were having a hard time getting their permits approved. And we finally got the permit approved. But in the backdrop of Shireen Abu Akleh being murdered in Jenin. Yeah. So this is happening as we're tech scouting and the people who are part of our crew knew Shireen. Oh. And these kids are coming from that city. One of the kids, that was the first time he ever left Jenin and saw the water.
Wow.
So people in our crew, Jewish American, well, actually might've been Canadian, who took him to the water and let him swim in the water of a place he had never been to and seen in his own homeland.
Wow.
But that episode in particular, we try to deal with a multitude of themes and stories that are so reminiscent of now. I don't know if something like that could happen now. Now, I think like a lot of us, it was eerie, this moment, this post 9/11 moment feeling. But I do think, and maybe this is me being an eternal optimist, that the fog is going to clear, the fog of war for some folks who've been resistant to seeing is going to clear. But profoundly, I don't know if I've seen a time where there's been such a shift around public opinion without needing to change the institutions. And that's what's different. And we've been trying to do the institutional rupture game. Mm-hmm. People didn't need that. People just needed to see the stories with their own eyes.
You know, the public has gone more towards these like streaming channels, and it's these smaller streaming channels that are showing things like Rami, Mo. My mind blew up when like Rami came on, because I was like, oh my God, they're actually like, you know, showing like Arabs. And then Mo comes on and talks about his Palestinian in exile experience and all of the crap that Palestinians go through. Oh my gosh, like they are going to turn people's hearts by sharing their own stories. This is so incredible. And then we see things like Farha coming out on Netflix, and other, you know, documentaries are coming out. And the, we really felt like, you know, we were on some kind of an upswing where public opinion was really going to be colored by these. But then October 7 suddenly happens. I don't know if that's going to continue on the upswing, or if even these channels will be influenced like the big ones and not cover them or not carry them anymore. So I'm not sure what's going
to
happen.
Well, so this is the thing I forgot to mention when I was talking about the conflict that's happening with these traditional networks, mainstream news spaces, is they know that the numbers are coming if they let our voices on. So they're so conflicted because they're used to, or they're committed to, maintaining institutional integrity. And institutional integrity means maintaining a system, maintaining a structure that will not be disrupted, will not have its fundamental premises challenged, right? Yeah. And their political commitments. The problem, I'll give you one clear, easy example, is Piers Morgan. Piers Morgan has been trying to put on voices that he knows are going to get him viral.
Views, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so that's what these folks are having a hard time. They know, I mean, they are watching the same numbers. They see, again, like Mutaz is getting the numbers, but then there's the threat for them in their minds that this is going to change the commitments, the political commitments they have by putting on these voices, by putting on the Noura Erekat, the Diana Butus, because they're folks that are uncompromising with how they understand the politics of what's happening in right. Palestine, in Gaza. And then the other layer of people who are experiencing what those politics do and mean, right? And so Piers Morgan has on Bassem Youssef. Well, how long was it? Like 40 minutes, hour long?
No, it was like an hour, yeah.
Yeah, an hour long clip of having Bassem Youssef use sarcasm to break through the stale propaganda that kept on being produced and reproduced. He said, you know, my wife's family is from Gaza, and, you know, her asshole cousins, you know, they said they couldn't come, but really we know that he's an asshole for not leaving. I mean, and he was just really exposing the ridiculousness around some of those things. And it was so great because Pierce had no idea how to disarm what was happening. And Bassem controlled the conversation in terms of, okay, I'm going to steer this towards where I want people to go. And comedy is this place that's going to shift your perspective, your paradigm for understanding politics, for understanding the prevailing
the Arab cultures, you know, because so many nuances. And then you're basing policy on this, and you're committing war crimes based on these misunderstandings that you've created and narratives that you've written. It's our job to take those narratives back. And I see that happening, but I don't know if it's going to continue.
I mean, my question is, does it matter? You know, does it matter that the institutions give us space, catch up? And we are. I mean, there are people fighting back, institutions using any kind of lane that is available, pushing politicians, and knowing too that our nation is so tied into what's happening over there, and we have to try everything and all the tools in our toolbox. But doesn't matter that institutions will not reflect what the public opinion, public will is. And why I'm saying that is does it mean that there could be a parallel movement towards creating our own institutions? I'm always profoundly befuddled by the fact that we still don't have social media outlets that we're using, right? I'm wondering, especially somebody who teaches Gen Z, that is like, you know, you want to try to prevent our hedge fund jobs? We don't want to work at a hedge fund. Mm-hmm. Do we need you? So I'm curious, and again, this is why my eyes on Gen Z, Gen Alpha, because I intuitively believe that they have come in this time with their generation to offer us new institution, new ways of being, new ways of seeing, new ways of thinking, new ways of relating through collaboration instead of competition, instead of these systems and structures that continue to tokenize. I mean, still.
So the answer is create our own streaming platforms, our own media platforms. And that like sings to my heart.
And you're already seeing a shift around the political language and the popular culture responses online to what is happening, right? Kind of in this anti-Vietnam War moment, like the majority of the public does not want to be involved in war. It's seeing this widening gap. It already has a distrust in institutions, right or left. This is political party agnostic. The institution can't save itself from what our public opinion is right now. So it either is going to respond to it or it might perish.
In terms of the media that you've studied, what recent coverage or narrative film do you think has been most damaging to Arabs and or Muslims in, like, let's say the past 20 years, like post 9/11?
The one that I play a clip of whenever I do workshops is from American Sniper. Bradley Cooper plays this trained sniper during the Iraq War. He's a U.S. Navy SEAL. It was directed by Clint Eastwood. It received 6 nominations, including Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Actor for Cooper, and just won an award for Best Sound Editing. It was part of these prestige terror genre films that were getting critical acclaim, Zero Dark Thirty, Argo.
Black Hawk Down.
Actually, it was released, look at you, December 2001. It was filmed before 9/11. Mm-hmm. American military intervention in Afghanistan was amplified.
Of course, yeah.
So American Sniper, what I thought was damaging about it was a crop of films that had emerged, which is these prestige terror genre dramas that were primarily focused on the experience of white women or men who were tasked to protect America against the terrorist Middle East, Central Asia, Africa. And in this story in particular, it is about the sad military guy who we have to, or the audience is compelled to sympathize with the crimes that they are forced to commit as part of the US's war in the region, and the kind of sympathetic skin we grow for somebody, an American.
The military.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
Now, why I think this is so dangerous is, first of all, have we ever seen a story from the perspective of an Iraqi about the Iraq War in American media?
I don't think so.
And so the best version of this is seeing how wrong the war was through white male military eyes. There's a moment where Chris Kyle, Bradley Cooper's character, is adjusting the crosshairs. A little Iraqi kid, must be 8, must be 10 years old, who's walking out of his house with his mother, who's in all black, because that's all we wear, are black bundles. And it looks like, and they're in an abandoned rubble-filled street. Then we zero in, because as audience, we're asking ourselves, why does he have the crosshairs? What's happening? Then we see the mom pull a grenade this big.
Out of the abaya.
A sizable grenade from under her black abaya and hand it to the kid. And so now we're here from the vantage point of Chris Kyle going through his calculation of, am I going to kill this kid? But look, this kid is dangerous. This little Iraqi boy is a threat to the biggest empire in the world. What ends up happening is he does shoot the kid. This is that killer kids trope. And then the mother, instead of mourning her child, picks up the grenade and throws it at a U.S. tank. We don't ask why there's a U.S. tank.
Because we don't love our children. We want our children to be martyred, always.
Right, right. But also, we're not going to take a moment to hold
to
our
grieve.
Child.
Yeah.
Right.
Never.
And we've seen, and again, that's why these images from Gaza are so powerful, because we're sitting there, we're watching a mother silently rock her child. I mean, one of the most
heartbreaking images. Yeah.
Yes. So every kind of level of ridiculousness is fortified in this storytelling of killer kid who is being trained by his mother to be an anti-American terrorist, and then to have the biggest military in the world be justified in targeting an Iraqi kid and his mom. That one scene, that under 2 minutes, is what I play at workshops, because there's so much packed into misconceptions and the brainwashing we have about our children and us as women. So again, it goes full circle to why, even if you say women and children, for some people who are disaffected by that framing, it's rooted in watching those stories. When we see things on the front lines that are directly challenging all of that programming, it is a profound moment.
Kind of a version of the last one. What film or media depiction of Arabs and or Muslims in the last 20 years do you think has most helped your public opinion of them? Do you ever show any clips of that kind of stuff?
Yeah, absolutely.
Oh, okay, cool.
A variety of things that I show people. Jackie Shalom has Slingshot Hip Hop, Paradise Now. Look up any Hiyama Bass film. She's the goddess of Palestinian filmmaking. Our show gets some love. Pushback from our community, but I think Rami, at the very least, produced an entry point for a different kind of storytelling about Arabs and Muslims than what had been on TV screens and in film for a long time. And I also think that film is amazing, but I've realized TV can be more powerful because you're creating characters that stay with you for a season, multiple seasons. You add Mo for that sort of comic relief to be the explainer. I don't know if people notice that, but he would explain parts of what it means to be Muslim, of Islamic practice, or even
opposite of Islamic practice. And, it's gritty and it's real. The actual lived experiences of a lot of Arabs and Muslims that we know.
Oh, something else that's coming out. Rami has an animated series with Amazon. That is about the day before 9/11 and all the subsequent days after. He brilliantly sat and said, okay, we didn't have that possibility back in 2001, and we weren't primed to do that either. Let's go back. Let's do this time travel with this family, I believe at the end of 2024. We still have more room for more stories. And so I think that's the important lesson, is we just need more stuff and we need to support the stuff that's out there.
I love that our generation is the generation that's seeing a lot of support for these storytellers, whether it's on stage, whether it's, you know, in front of the camera, even the comics. You know, it's just now, if like a kid was a comic, I think coming out of our Masjid family, we would be so happy and so proud. Like, oh, good job, baby. You know, like our moms would have died.
Really?
They would have died of shame. Yeah. But all of us were like ready, standing ovation. Let's go. Everybody buy tickets. Our baby's on stage, you know? So I think that has changed internally within the community. So I think that support is coming. Simple things like post 10/7, where the community in like 24 hours, 48 hours is able to produce $40,000 to get a billboard, to rent a billboard, to save Gaza. Like, that's huge. Like, cause we're realizing that that kind of digital media is going to be really important. We need to invest in those kinds of things in order to, you know, combat the billboards that were saying, oh, this child was kidnapped by Hamas. Okay. We agree. That's important. But what about this child who was killed by an occupation soldier?
Related to that, not necessarily Arab and Muslim representation, but a film that I'm looking forward to seeing, I haven't yet, is Realism. It tracks the stories of Jewish folks in the diaspora who go to Israel and join the army and try to connect to the Zionism that they were raised in. And then it's a brutal awakening into what all of this really means. Digs deep and unpacking the propaganda that these folks have been exposed to. And it's part of a movement that's happening with Jewish Voices for Peace. Folks are waking up altogether. Yeah. Another film where I interviewed the filmmaker, it blows your mind because it is about a year, an event that we're talking about now in more detail, 1948, the Nakba. There's a film called Tantura. How aggressive the campaign was directed towards a Jewish man who was doing a master's to uncover this, the targeted...
The making of a pariah who is just trying to get the stories of the occupation soldiers at the time and then accidentally found out that they were all murderers. You know, I don't think that was his intent. Maybe because he was a student of Ilan Pape, he had a feeling that he would find out, but I don't think that was his intent.
It's interesting because one of the biggest, the parts in the film that really struck me the most was the MGM filming.
Yes. Crew. I'm not crazy. Yeah.
And I asked the filmmaker about it because it is documentary gold to be able to find this archival footage of MGM going in and trying to
do the PR campaign. It's like, look, we forcibly removed these people, but we're giving them water along the way. How nice are we?
And I mean, the most profound part of that storytelling was they were trying to show a land that didn't have people, but they couldn't erase the massacre. My friend Will Yeomans also has a film that folks should be on the lookout for. He about the murder of Alex Odeh, head of the ADC, Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee in Southern California. He was murdered at his office in Orange County.
Oh, wow.
And it is tied to a radical Zionist group that escaped persecution by seeking safe haven in Israel. But it was kind of clear that there's complicity with US agencies that this film uncovers. Oh. So it's fascinating because an Israeli journalist named David Sheen is trying to revive this case and find out who the murderers were, if they're still alive. So what they identify is this extremist group, this Zionist extremist group, is responsible for the rise of extremists who kill Yitzhak Rabin, is also connected to the rising tide of support for Netanyahu. This film, I wish it could come out sooner because that press Israelism is such a good complement to how we can see what's happening right now.
This is awesome. Thank you so much for agreeing to come back on and fitting us into your schedule. I really, really appreciate it. We're going to do our utmost to include all of your book and movie recommendations, documentary recommendations in our show notes, which our audience can check out on the show notes tab on the website. Thank you so much for coming again, Dr. Al-Hassan, and thanks everybody for tuning in. Assalamu alaikum.
Thanks again for joining Zeba and Uzma on Momming While Muslim today.
Please email us your thoughts or questions and follow us on Facebook and Instagram because this podcast was designed to cater your needs.
Make sure you check out the show notes to find the links and resources for this episode. And remember to help a mama out and leave a review of the show as well as to like it on your podcast app of choice because that helps us grow.
Tune in next week for another episode of Momming While Muslim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone.